Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
What with the grand exit of David Tennant's Doctor Who and the resurrection of John Wyndham's Triffids, both on television over Christmas, there can't be many of you left who can cross your hearts and say you never have anything to do with science fiction. And even if you can, don't switch off. By the end of this podcast, we hope to have convinced you that it offers a rich and valuable literature. On hand with his tips as to what to read as SF blogger Damian Walter and Sarah Crown, editor of the Guardian Books website. Welcome both. We'll also be talking to the novelist China Mieville about his latest take on the genre. But first, can you put a name to the author of this passage from a novel about that old SF favourite, The Clone?
The cop they put me onto a police record studied Frida's photograph carefully.
"Quicker to trace if you have the fingerprints," he told me.
I explained that I didn't have the fingerprints and that it wasn't that girl that I wanted to know about, but someone just like her. He wasn't impressed.
"If you were in this job, you'd have had enough practice to know that nobody looks just like anybody but himself. Well, except a very few twins, maybe. What's a lay?"
"I'd not know. Unless you'd call being a corpse a lay," I told him. He grunted and went away. A few minutes later, he was back, with a regulation-sized picture in his hand.
"There you are. Fell or was pushed off a fire escape in this city about a week ago."
"I know about her. She's not the one. Another just like her," I told him, hoping there might be.
"Well, can't be just like both," he objected.
"These two look just alike to me," I said.
"Well, they would to an amateur," he told me,
and went away again without explaining the subtleties visible to his professional eye. When he came back next time, he was holding two pictures. He laid one of them down on the desk.
"Found near the westbound track, 10 miles east of Flagstaff, Arizona," he observed.
I examined it. Take away the high arch eyebrows, put in the real ones, lighten the hair a little, flatten the perm a trifle, and there we were again. "Smart of you," I said, to please him.
"Filed under blondes on account of it was dyed," he said,
as if in some sort of explanation.
"Mostly, of course, it's the other way."
"Could we reproduce it?"
"It ain't for me to say, but I guess so. Then there's this one,"
he added, holding up the other picture. It was a shocker.
"Fished out of the Hudson. Must have mixed it with something," he told me.
It certainly had. "We couldn't print that," I said. He agreed.
"But see that side of the face?"
He pointed.
"It might be..."
He was right, too. It very well might be. I asked him how I got copies. He told me, then, looking again at the first two, he frowned. With a professional reluctance, he admitted,
"It sure is pretty near a dupe. Must have been twins. Though the one you've got's not quite so near a dupe. What do you know?"
"So far, less and less every minute," I told him.
That was Chris Moran reading from Plan for Chaos, a previously unpublished novel by John Wyndham, written at the same time as Day of the Triffids. Sarah, tell us what it's all about.
Yes, although Wyndham wrote it at the same time as he wrote Day of the Triffids, it's actually nothing like it at all. It's the biggest difference is that it's set in America, and the second biggest difference is that it doesn't really feel to me much like an SF novel at all. Although it's about clones and cloning, it has much more similarity, I think, with sort of crime. And Dashiell Hammett was the comparison you made earlier, Claire. It starts off in America with this man who is going out with his cousin, rather interestingly, although there's a plot reason for that. And it continues as he finds lots of women who look quite a lot like his cousin, his fiancée. This leads him into a world that is sort of linked deeply into the Nazi regime that had been, you know, around the Second World War, ended about a decade, I think, before this book was written. And we get taken off to South America and into a camp, sort of an unknown camp full of ex-Nazis or current Nazis, I suppose, who are trying to kind of resurrect the Third Reich. And so, yes, it's an interesting book and not very Wyndham-esque at all.
He does American dialogue rather clunkily, doesn't he?
Yes, a lot of guys in there and kinders and that sort of thing. And it's obviously that he's such a kind of a British author. The way that he speaks, his sentence structure, everything just sort of resonates with Britishness. And so to have him dropping in these sort of strange, twangy Americanisms all the way through was a quite disconcerting experience, particularly because it you had the feeling that, you know, every fifth line he'd think, oh, God, I've got to remember it's set in America. And so then he'd drop in something and yes, it didn't quite gel together for me.
Now, Damien, can you see any similarities with his more famous work?
Well, I think this really represents a kind of transitional work from John Wyndham. He had been writing for a number of years before the publication of Day of the Triffids and his big success in the UK for American pulp publishers. And that was a very different style of writing and possibly one he wasn't as competent at as actually his later, more developed British style. But you do see him really struggling between these two different styles that he's trying to adopt and the one that he'll later perfect in Day of the Triffids. You see the kind of clipped Britishness of it. I really can't think of a more British author than John Wyndham, actually. Just the name in itself is incredibly British.
Well, I was thinking, sorry to interrupt you, but sure. what I realised that he reminded me of as I was reading this new book is that a lot of it, the intonation, the sentence rhythm and everything, and even in this case, the sort of the slightly crimey noir story, reminded me quite a lot of John Buchan, who's, you know, another kind of definitively British writer, and that he has that sort of that rhythm, that cadence to his sentences, I think.
I think quite possibly an influence on Wyndham at the time, actually, because he was really writing in the adventure story kind of genre at the time as well. I think what you really see coming through, though, although he doesn't do it as successfully as later novels at all, is the kind of building sense of menace that Wyndham is really famous for, and the fact that he's giving kind of in each chapter a few more facts which are giving the big picture of the story that he's unfolding. And I think maybe one of the problems with Wyndham these days is in some ways people are very familiar with his stories now, and also a lot of these plots have been taken up and recycled in other formats. So we really know as modern readers where he's going right from the beginning of the book, so we don't get to necessarily have that experience of seeing him unfold it.
Mm. Now, I've tried to read Trouble with Lichen with my daughter, and she couldn't get it at all. I mean, the language is completely alienating for her. Do you think his novels stand up today?
I think that they do, yes. I think that they do, particularly in terms of the more deeper subtext within his books on the satire on British society. Although perhaps we've moved on a little bit now from the kind of deeply politically and socially repressive society that Wyndham was commenting on. But nonetheless, I think there's a lot that's still interesting for modern readers on there. Although I do have to say I wish that perhaps organisations like the BBC would adapt maybe a few more contemporary writers as well, rather than just sticking to
rather than bringing out those trundling plants yet again. Yes. Would you recommend Plan for Chaos for listeners who don't know Wyndham?
I would probably recommend it for Wyndham fanatics, really. I'd recommend it for the Wyndham completist who wants to pick up the entire picture of his career. I think it's still a competent and good novel and people will enjoy reading it, but really it's going to be for the real Wyndham fans out there.
And if you're not a real Wyndham fan, where would you start?
Personally, I would start actually with The Chrysalids.
Which... Me too.
I'm the odd one out. I kind of stick up with The Triffids. I said in Hay that I thought it was one of the great books of the century, and this gasp went through the audience.
I completely agree. I think it's absolutely wonderful.
It's a great metaphor, isn't it? It's a great image. It's become a sort of myth, one of our myths, hasn't it?
And I have this kind of amazing personal connection with Day of the Triffids because my dad read me quite a lot of Wyndham as a child. And we went on holiday to the Lake District and I slipped on a rock in a stream and split my chin open. Had to be taken to Ambleside Health Centre to have gravel kind of picked out of my chin and it all stitched up, and they couldn't give me any anaesthetic. And my dad at the time was reading me Day of the Triffids, so he was there with me, reading to me. I was aged about 10, I guess, reading to me from Day of the Triffids as a very nice nurse lady picked gravel out of my chin. So I have this kind of real sort of sense memory of it, and it was a great distraction. I just think it's
There you go, John Wyndham, better than anaesthetic. Plan for Chaos is published by Penguin, and you can get it and any other books mentioned on this podcast from guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Just before Christmas, we asked bloggers to nominate their book of the previous decade by year, and it prompted a spirited exchange when David M.W. made a bid for Ian MacDonald's Brazil as his book of 2007. For those of you who don't read SF out of some misguided idea that it isn't real literature or lacks literary qualities, you need to take a look at this for a lesson in how to construct a novel in terms of style and the ability to sustain a narrative whilst dealing with complex scientific, religious, social and political themes, he wrote. To which Resurgence 27, they have rather wonderful science fiction names, these bloggers, responded, "My chief gripe with sci-fi and fantasy is that I've yet to find a writer who is as deft with and takes as much delight in language as any of a good dozen literary novelists." Damien, that's red rag to a bull, I should imagine.
Oh, well, quite possibly, yes. I've been known to comment on things like this on the Guardian Books blog itself as well. I think the kind of statement that's come from the second commenter there, you hear quite often about science fiction. And I'd have to admit, in many ways it's true, but it's also somewhat of an obvious statement. It's rather like saying about punk rock music that it doesn't have the subtlety and complexity of classical composition. It doesn't, quite clearly, but it's communicating in a very, very different way. And with science fiction, you're really looking at a literature that isn't about the language in the same way that literary fiction is. It is much more about ideas, about metaphors, and also about a kind of raw excitement that doesn't always fit into the kind of more formal language that more literary fiction uses.
Mm-hmm. Would you agree about Brazil?
I think Brazil is one of a number of novels, and Ian MacDonald is one of a number of science fiction novelists who are deserving of a much wider readership. And unfortunately, they sometimes fall between the cracks because their work is more complex than average commercial science fiction, but still not really being publicised to readers of more literary fiction. So people like Ian MacDonald, Adam Roberts, whose book Yellow Blue Tibia is a really brilliant satire on kind of communist Russia, which came out this year, and Jeff Vandermeer as well, the American fantasist, whose novel Finch has these great noir overtones mixed with weird and speculative fiction as well. So I think there's a whole group of novelists out there really deserving of more attention.
Sarah, do you read science fiction?
I do. I probably read less, sorry Damien about this, but I was going to say I probably read less contemporary SF than perhaps I ought to do or could, and that's partly a job thing really of having to kind of do quite a lot of reading for work. But I had a huge SF phase in my sort of teens and early 20s, and particularly I think, you know, if you're gonna start reading this sort of literature, you could do a lot worse than start with some of the classics, like people like Arthur C. Clarke, who I absolutely loved. And my particular favourite of that, what I think is interesting about SF is that it can often give you new scenarios in which to explore old ideas. And so one of my favourite Arthur C. Clarke books is one that's not sort of terribly well known of his, called The Fall of Moondust, which is set on the moon. It's quite sort of small scale SF. It's not a big space opera. It's, you know, we've colonised the moon and I think we've colonised Mercury and Mars and that's about it. It's about a sort of a tourist bus of a spaceship, really, that goes across the Sea of Tranquility on the moon, and a slow, slow bubble from the centre of the moon is kind of creeping up over millennia and bursts just as this spaceship is travelling across it. And the spaceship gets sucked down and it's stuck under about 20 feet of moon dust. And they have to work out how to get down to these people before the air runs out. And it's just a classic. It's a sort of like a closed room mystery, I suppose, except from the outside. How do you get to people? How do you get through this impenetrable stuff in this very odd arena? And so there are all these kind of just very interesting, quite basic problems of physics that you have to contend with. And it's just fascinating and it's so dramatic and it's kind of heart in the mouth stuff, you know, where you're thinking, God, at the end of every chapter there's another catastrophe and you think, oh, they're going to go on fire, they all have to go to sleep at one point. That was brilliant. So anyway, that was a bit of
that's
a rant.
Enough. But I love that. But although we love him.
Then also, sorry, I'm going to sort of come up with something a bit more modern. I think Kim Stanley Robinson is fantastic and his Mars trilogy is just absolutely magisterial.
Oh yeah, we've plugged that one a few times on this programme,
yes,
haven't we?
Probably me.
Now, there was an intriguing clash of values last year in Saturday Review when Ursula Le Guin said she might have been more favourably inclined towards Margaret Atwood's novel The Year of the Flood if she had owned up to it being science fiction. Now, I'm just going to quote her because it seems a very peculiar one, this. I could talk about her new book more freely, more truly, if I could talk about it as what it is, using the lively vocabulary of modern science fiction criticism, giving it the praise it deserves as a work of unusual cautionary imagination and satirical invention. As it is, I must restrict myself to the vocabulary and expectations suitable to a realistic novel, even if forced by those limitations into a less favourable stance. Now, Sarah, what is that about?
Well, I think she's making a point, really. I think she's restricting herself to make a point, really, which is that Margaret Atwood will not go down the road of having her books classified as science fiction. And this is irritating, I think, to the science fiction community, because that's blatantly what they are. There is no question that The Year of the Flood was a science fiction novel. And so I think, you know, Ursula Le Guin is definitely putting the brakes on herself to make this point on a platform where she might be heard.
And SF writers love categories, don't they? They're always coming up with new ones. We've got, space opera, fantasy, steampunk. Steampunk? What's steampunk, for goodness sake?
Steampunk, cyberpunk.
Weird.
Weird fiction.
Tell us what they are. Why do they have to have categories of their own? Do they have separate readers?
I think because science fiction and fantasy grew up as almost a separate literary tradition, kind of born in pulp magazines and dime novels, that they are very much their own tradition, and the writers who are involved in that are very proud of what's been contributed to that tradition over the last 100 years or so. So when a novelist like Margaret Atwood, for instance, who writes great science fiction novels for various reasons,
let's hope she's not listening,
denies that they're within the science fiction tradition, obviously that, you know, raises a reaction from people who are deeply involved with that tradition, who want to see it acknowledged more. And I think that's quite worthy to do. However, I would say that there's also, and I'm guilty of it as much as anyone, a slight geekishness in wanting to classify every single book into some kind of subgenre or another, which perhaps science fiction is a bit overly guilty of as well.
Now, a writer who's got as close as any in the last few years to crossing over from SF to literary fiction, or should that be the other way around, is China Mieville. He's been described as the new weird, and the world of Bazlag, which he created in his early books such as Perdido Street Station, found favour with both SF fans and literary critics. He's recently written two novels which layer one world on another. In The City and the City, the investigation of a crime is made doubly complicated by geographical and mental boundaries which may not be crossed. Michel Pauly asked him how he set about writing a whodunit with a twist.
It's an attempt to be completely faithful to the sort of police procedural whodunit, but with in a setting that is more odd than it maybe originally appears. And this is something I kind of avoided talking about for ages because I'm really neurotic about spoilers, but I figure anyone who cares will know to avoid it now. So basically, it's set in two cities which inhabit the same physical space but sort of separate through kind of very, very rigid rules and taboos and norms and a whole process of conceptual avoidance of noticing each other. Murder obviously ends up being more complicated than it looks, and so there's various shenanigans about borders and that sort of thing in it too.
One of the joys of the novel I found is thinking through some of the practicalities of how these two overlapping cities would actually work in practice. You know, at one point you talk about traffic rules and how emergency vehicles cope. Was it fun for you figuring out these kinds of details, and how much of that sort of untangling did you have to do in order to write the city?
It was a lot of fun. I think it's always this kind of line between taking the idea very, very seriously and sort of extrapolating all those kind of minutiae, and at the same time keeping in the back of your head but not getting bogged down by the fact that it is an absurdity. It's pretty ridiculous. But given that it's an absurdity, now how would it work? And there's an awful lot of sort of absurdities of everyday life. And so it was just kind of taking that kind of logic and just sort of slightly extrapolating it and sort of exaggerating it. And the other thing about trying to work out how those things would work is that they would obviously involve little low-level breakings of the rules all the time. But that didn't bug me as part of the writing, because part of what I was sort of interested in playing with was the idea that these rules are broken all the time. It's not just a book about taboos, but about their completely inevitable ongoing breakage.
You do leave a huge amount to the reader's imagination, and especially at the beginning, it's very much down to the reader to pick up the clues and gradually suss out what's going on. You talk about cross-hatching and total areas and alters. In this sense, it's a very stripped-down work compared with your previous novels, which, you know, were wildly baroque. Why the restraint?
wildly baroque. I think when you don't always necessarily just want to do the same thing, and I don't just mean in terms of setting, but also in terms of style and form. It's just interesting to sort of experiment. And I think because this book, I had wanted very much to be very, very sort of faithful to a kind of post-noir-y type paradigm. And to a certain extent, that much more kind of stripped-down prose is a homage to that kind of, you know, classic thing, sort of Chandler-esque, and that particular kind of tradition of rather more terse crime writing than I'm known for. I don't think my other novels, you know, of all the things good, bad, and indifferent people would say about them, terse would not be one. So it was kind of interesting to try and get into that voice. And it was also because I was interested in trying to do a slightly different kind of alienation, of estrangement, I should say. So whereas with the other books, there's quite a sort of big, sort of rumbustious, exaggerated attempt to estrange the reader from everything they know, with this one, it was much more an attempt to do a sort of uneasy half-familiarity. So the book starts off and you sort of feel like you more or less understand what's going on, and then there's a creeping realization that actually there's stuff that you're not quite getting. And that was done much more through withholding than through excess, a surplus of detail and information. So it was trying to for a kind of different effect, and also it was just more of an interesting way to get into the head of the main character. He doesn't tend to be someone who says an awful lot, even to himself.
The LA Times described The City in the City as Philip K. Dick and Raymond Chandler's love child raised by Franz Kafka. It sounds from what you're saying as if you'd agree with that as a fairly accurate description, and that you owe a debt to these writers with this book.
Well, it would be wildly hubristic to agree with it, but certainly, I mean, that was an absolutely lovely, lovely review, and I was pleased because, as you say, that reviewer, I thought, was right in sort of pointing at the kind of feelings and the kind of influences that would give the same kind of atmosphere that I was hoping people would experience, although I would throw other names in. I mean, Kafka's obviously a very important influence, but Bruno Schultz is probably as big or greater an influence for me, at a conscious level anyway, on that book. So,
no, I've seen Orwell mentioned as well, which I imagine you're quite pleased with.
I am, but to be perfectly honest, and this sounds unbelievably sort of ungrateful, and I really don't mean it this way, but some of the times the way Orwell is invoked, I'm slightly uneasy about. Not always. I mean, I would say not always, but sometimes there's an attempt to sort of read the book as an allegory. This one city represents one thing, one represents another, or it's about totalitarianism or so on. I mean, I don't, you know, whatever readers get out of it, you know, I'm not, that's up to them. But for me at least, I don't really like kind of narrowly allegorical readings. I like sort of metaphoric readings that go off in all kinds of directions, but you know, I mean, to me, you know, the cities have to feel kind of blooded and real and like themselves, and it has to feel like a genuine murder mystery where you want to find out who's killed the young woman, as well as all these other stuff. So I do slightly get uneasy when people sort of say, oh, you know, what does this mean? What does this represent?
In that case, I suspect you're not going to be too happy with my next question to you, which is that you're often described as an urban fantasist, and cities are the central character in all your novels. For me, arguably, the two coexisting cities in The City and the City come closest to describing the reality of living in a big city like London, where different groups of people can live just metres apart and have almost no overlap. The lives that they lead, they're effectively unseeing each other. And I was wondering if your two cities are just an extreme example of this kind of atomised living.
Absolutely, and that question doesn't raise my hackles at all, because, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. That's to do with the kind of embedded logic of a setting. And, I mean, I like what you say because, you know, although the logic of these two cities being separated is, you know, as I say, on one level absurd, it was quite important to me that all it is an exaggeration of logics that surround us every day. And as you say, one of the mechanisms by which we live in cities, both for good and bad, is learning to filter out an extraordinary amount of information. And a lot of that information is coloured by, you know, kind of preconceptions of prejudice and class and race and that sort of thing. But also at a kind of geopolitical level, you know, I mean, a lot of the thing is to do with borders between nations, and borders between nations are very interesting, between states, I should say, because they are both, on one level, completely arbitrary. You know, the border may be here or it may be 1 foot to the left. You know, there's no kind of concrete logical reason for it not being 1 foot to the left. So it's arbitrary, but at the same time, it's an arbitrary absurdity that will kill you. It has very, very real effects, because if you're standing one foot the wrong side of it, you know, you can get shot. And so that logic of kind of exaggerated but extremely dangerous arbitrariness, and again, as you say, very kind of everyday logics, are exactly what I was trying to kind of exaggerate and sort of extrapolate. So I hope that the book is not informed by invented logics or alien logics. It's informed by sort of extrapolated and slightly exaggerated but recognisable ones.
That was China Mieville talking to Michel Pauly about The City in the City, which is just out in paperback from Pan. So finally, Damien, could you give us a brief run through your top tips for 2010?
Absolutely. I think 2010, as an overall trend, might see the decline of the paranormal romance, which has taken over bookshelves and cinema screens with the Twilight saga in the last couple of years. And it might actually be replaced by a return of the epic fantasy, because, fingers crossed, 2010 should be the year with the release of A Dance with Dragons, the fifth volume of George R.R. Martin's epic fantasy, which is also currently being filmed as a mini-series for HBO. So if you haven't yet heard of George R.R. Martin, you probably will have by the end of 2010. There's also another big fantasy release coming from China Mieville, whose next novel, Kraken, is released in 2010 and will almost certainly be a big hit, and quite possibly bring him to that more literary audience who is starting to notice him now. I'd also look forward to City of Ruin, which is the second volume in the Knights of Villamere sequence by Mark Sharon Newton. And on the science fiction side of things, the big tip for this year's Hugo Award is The Wind-Up Girl by Paolo Bacigalupi, who not only has a fantastic name but also publishes fantastic dystopian science fiction novels and stories. So all to look out for in 2010.
Goodness, do you ever have time to read anything else?
I squeeze in the occasional bit of literary fiction here and there.
Well, that's it for our science fiction special. Thanks to Damien Walter, Sarah Crown and Chris Moran, also to China Mieville and Michel Pauly. I'm Claire Armistead, and the programme was produced by Tim Mabey. Goodbye.